morning in commemoration of the 549th anniversary. We're going to have a blowout next year. The 549th anniversary of the first Book of Common Prayer. We're using the communion rite from the 1549 prayer book. Now, prior to the English Reformation, the forms of parish worship in the late medieval church in England varied from place to place. Each diocese might have its own way of doing things. But by far, the most common form in England was the Sarum or Salisbury Rite, whose language, of course, was Latin. And in order to do the liturgy, one had to have a multitude of books. There was the Missal for the Mass. There was the breviary for morning and evening prayer. There was the manual for the occasional offices such as baptisms and marriages and burials. And there was the pontifical, which was the bishop's book that he used for confirmations and ordinations. And the preface to the 1549 prayer book charged that many times there was more business to find out what should be read than to read it when it was found out. So the work of producing one single English language prayer book for throughout the whole country was largely that of Thomas Cranmer, who was Archbishop of Canterbury under Henry VIII and later under Edward VI. Now, as you all know from confirmation class, the English Reformation was largely a reform of church government and not a change of theology like the Lutheran and Reformed churches on the continent. It was never the intention of the English reformers to create a Protestant church, but rather a Reformed English Catholic church. And for that reason, certain medieval abuses which had crept into the liturgy of the church over the years had to be purified. And yet, whatever of the past could be retained was retained. So the 1549 prayer book was a moderate reform. And it would have been very accessible and very familiar to those who'd used the Sarum Rite, albeit now in English. Now, as often happens with compromises, many of the more reformed-minded, we would nowadays call them Protestant Anglicans, found the 1549 prayer book too Catholic. Well, many of those who preferred the pre-Reformation rites found the book too Protestant. And in fact, the 1549 prayer book was replaced very shortly after by the 1552 prayer book, which revised the liturgy in a Protestant direction, and then in 1559 and 1662 prayer books, things moved back onto a more Catholic tract. Now, before our worship begins, and in place of the sermon this morning, I want to briefly say a few words of introduction about the 1549 communion rite. The first thing you'll notice if you look at the front of your bulletin is the title. The Supper of the Lord and the Holy Communion, commonly called the Mass. Now, the Lord's Supper was a Protestant term for the Eucharist, while Mass harkened back to the pre-Reformation liturgies. In the use of both terms, we see an attempt to marry these two traditions. Now, many Episcopalians think that the word Mass is a sort of crypto-Roman import into Anglicanism, but in fact, it's been there from the very beginning. In the same vein, the peace, which was seen to be a new thing with the 1979 prayer book, is likewise of great antiquity, being found in liturgies dating far back as the New Testament. The 1549 prayer book includes the peace, although it was a simple greeting and response without accompanying gesture. If you go under the title, you see the opening rubrics or rules. We read that the clergy were to wear a vestment, meaning a chasuble or a cope. And in contrast to the continental reformers, the English church retained the traditional Eucharistic vestments, as well as church furnishings such as stained glass, which was often smashed by the continental reformers as being graven images. In the same way, on the continent, among the Lutherans and the Reformed churches, the altars were removed from the church building on the grounds that an altar implied that the Eucharist was, in fact, a real sacrifice, which of course it is, and were instead replaced by much more simple wooden communion tables, more in keeping with the Protestant idea of the Lord's Supper as a bare commemorative meal. Moreover, on the continent, the communion table would often be put into storage during the 48 Sundays or so when it wasn't being used, or as a place to pile hats, coats, and books. And instead, the pulpit was moved to the front and center of the church. In England, the altars were retained and they were kept in the place of prominence. The two candles on the altar were in keeping with the Sarum Rite, which likewise used only two candles. Our modern use of six candles, almost now completely universal in parishes that follow an Anglo-Catholic model of liturgy, in fact, comes from the Tridentine Roman Rite and only became customary in Anglicanism in the 19th century. So, by maintaining all of these familiar forms, Cranmer hoped to establish the practice of weekly congregational communion. There were instructions in the prayer book that the priest was not to receive communion alone. And this represented a radical change from late medieval practice, whereby the primary focus of congregational worship was simple attendance at Mass and elevation of the consecrated host. In late medieval England, the faithful only received communion regularly once a year at Easter, and otherwise lay people might expect to receive communion only on their deathbed or at the nuptial mass in which they were married. Well, so while retaining the idea of a real consecration of the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, the 1549 prayer book ordered that there be no elevation of the host and chalice and that Sanctus bells not be rung. Now, much of the wording that you're going to hear this morning will be familiar to those who grew up with the 1928 prayer book or who attend Rite One Masses here. As was the case until the 1979 prayer book of the Episcopal Church, only two lessons are read, an epistle and a gospel with a short snippet of the Psalms in between. In 1549, both lessons would have been read by the clergy, but today we'll keep our usual custom of having the first lesson read by a layperson. The gospel procession, where there was one, was much shorter, and the gospel itself was read facing the liturgical north, a custom that developed in the primitive church to symbolize the need to preach the gospel to the barbarian tribes that lived beyond the northern borders of the Roman Empire. The 1549 prayer book ordered that women and children sit on the right of the church and that men sit on the left. Acolytes, which were exclusively male, were preserved in the first prayer book, but we won't be observing either of those two customs this morning. The sermon, if there was one, followed the creed, reversing the order that we're used to. And I say if there was one, because in the volatile Reformation era, only certain clergy were licensed to preach, for fear that non-approved theological or political opinions might be voiced from the pulpit. Those who didn't hold a license to preach we're bound to read one of the lengthy sermons out of the book of homilies. 40, 45 minutes it would take to get through those, and we won't be observing that custom this morning either. Mass was said with the priest facing toward the east, as it was in almost every Episcopal and Roman Catholic church prior to the liturgical reforms of the 1960s, and is still done in some. You know, regardless of its true geographical position, the altar is always said to be in the east end of the church, facing the place of the rising sun, S-U-N, from which the risen sun, S-O-N, will return at his glorious second coming. And instead of thinking that the priest is saying Mass with his back to the people, we should instead think that the priest and the people are facing the same way. And you'll notice that when the priest speaks to God on behalf of the people, he faces east. But when he speaks to the people from God, he turns and faces the faithful. And that can be a very powerful symbol even today. You'll note that there are no hymns in this service. Hymns make a rather late appearance on the liturgical scene. The idea of setting poetry to music was deemed, which is what a hymn is, was deemed to be inappropriate to dignified worship. Most of the hymns that we call traditional are in fact no more than 200 years old. And it was the Methodist movement of the 18th century that can be credited with introducing hymns into worship. Instead, the service would have been sung by lay clerks, both men and boys, attached to cathedrals, college chapels, and other large churches, a custom that we still see in the choirs of the Church of England. Organs would have been used in the English church, in contrast to the continent, where in many places the organs were destroyed as being popish. Traditional liturgical chant was likewise maintained in the Church of England, although radically simplified. Now, to our sensibilities, the 1549 service has little congregational participation. Many of the prayers that we are accustomed to saying together, like the Our Father and the General Confession and the Prayer of Humble Access, are said by the priest alone. But if you consider that in the Latin Rite, there was no congregational participation whatsoever, Cranmer's prayer book would have seemed downright democratic. So a brief introduction to the first prayer book. Remember that while we are using a historic liturgy, we're not play-acting, but instead we're offering the same sacrifice of praise and prayer that we do each Lord's Day, but in the manner and words of our forerunners in the faith. And as always, our goal in worship is to do everything in good order, to praise and magnify God, and to edify our fellow believers. You please stand.